Welcome to the April edition of the Sands and its Storm Centers Thread Update. This podcast was originally broadcast as a webcast. If you would like, there are PDF slides available on the Sands Webcast Archive at sands.org/webcasts. And thank you to Core Security Technologies for sponsoring this podcast. Let's go briefly over the outline of today's webcast. First, very briefly, I want to talk a little bit about yesterday's Microsoft patches. We had, of course, a real rich patch Tuesday yesterday, but I don't really want to waste too much time on that because really there wasn't really that much special or new other than the sheer volume of patches that we had to deal with yesterday. Then a little bit about current threats. What are we seeing right now? What are the things that you and your users should really be aware of? And then the bulk of the webcast, probably about two-thirds of it, I'll dedicate to DNSSEC. DNSSEC, of course, the protocol that's supposed to save DNS. And I do see in recent compliance changes and such where DNSSEC is picking up some steam. So let's first talk about the April patch Tuesday. Microsoft this time fixed 64 vulnerabilities. So that's a new record, I believe, for what they did in the past. 17 bulletins total. Now, overall, those bulletins were actually not that special or new. Still, the bulk of the bulletins and the threat here really affects clients. Like we had a number of important fixes for Office, for example, and two of the Office and Internet Explorer related patches are the ones for which we already have seen exploitation in the wild. So those are certainly the patches that you should address first. I really think at this point in time, Windows patching is something that you have to have down, where really a large update like this is not really causing you too much headache. You need to test those patches. You need to verify that your custom software and such is not affected, negatively affected by any of them. But then really it's just a matter of going through the motions with that. The focus here really should be less on speed, but a little bit more on procedure and making that entire process reproducible. So you're absolutely sure that you have all of these patches actually applied to your system. There was one set of patches was a little bit different than what we usually see, and those are patches to Microsoft's developers tools. Not the first time they do it, but of course, there's always the question, do these patches apply to me or not? Well, in some ways, they apply to you even if you're not a developer. And that's really what comes down to how software is created and distributed. A developer has two options to distribute software. First of all, the software may be compiled by dynamically linking system libraries. In that case, libraries that you find on all Windows systems are not actually included in the binary blob that the developer creates. Instead, as the software runs, it will load those libraries dynamically, and it will load whatever version it finds on the system on which it runs. The other option is to statically compile libraries. In that case, all the libraries are actually included in the binary blob that you receive from your software distributor, from your developer. In that case, of course, well, you may have a newer version of the library on your system, but it's not used. The library that's statically included with the software is used. In the first case, when the software is linked dynamically, the developer really has to do nothing for a patch like this. You as a user have to apply the patch, and as a result, you will end up with the newest version of the library. Next time you start up that piece of software, it will load these newest versions of these libraries. If it's statically linked, then the developer has to again compile the binary and send you a new version of it using these newer versions of the binaries, of the libraries. So the developer has to actually recompile and redistribute the code in the second case. Microsoft actually had this wrong in the first release of their advisory. The FAQ stated that developers have to re-release whenever they link dynamically. They don't have to re-release when they link statically. Well, they got that reversed. So if you link dynamically, you're all set. Just make sure all the systems the software runs on is patched. If you link statically, you have to re-release. So this was a little bit different than what we usually see, but patches like this for developer tools have, of course, existed in past Patch Tuesday. So it's not 100% new and different. Now let's talk a little bit about current threats. And of course, we are about a week away from the tax deadline, which is usually April 15th. Because of weekend and holidays, you got a couple of days more this year. In the US, each year, April 15th is the deadline to file personal income tax returns. And in the past, what we have seen is where phishing scams and such are trying to take advantage of the overall sort of hoopla awareness and work that is associated with this particular date. So what you may find is, for example, offers to file your taxes for free. Sometimes for online filing, you're charged a fee. And, well, those fake services sometimes do it for free. And, well, will take all your personal details and really do it as a phishing scam. Now, yes, there may be legitimate services that do it for free. Really, it comes down to good judgment. Don't sign up for a service where the first time you ever heard of them is the day before the tax deadline, but go with reputable services. Don't click on links that come in random emails. The IRS will not send out emails with links to try to tell you about taxes you owe or are being returned. Now, so far, I haven't really seen a lot of these this year, so maybe actually that's some of the defenses that people put in place, like spam, phishing filters, and such, are doing a decent job in cleaning up after these, or just that the IRS also got faster in actually trying to shut them down. I have seen a number of foreign versions that basically told me that I am owed money by the UK or Australian or whatever tax authorities. That's, of course, another thing that you may see as a part of tax season. One new scam that sort of came up this year is where the email that you get does not actually ask you to go to a particular website. Instead, it asks you to fax in the information that they would like to phish for you. And of course, that fax is going to a Dropbox of some phisher. Same idea as phishing, just using a fax as making it look more legit, more secure. And then, of course, we had yet another Adobe Flash Zero Day. This time it was exploited by including the Flash file in a Word document. I have seen techniques like this used in the past for, well, not malware, but by people that try to bypass corporate controls in order to sneak Flash games into their corporate desktop. So in those cases, Flash was not really allowed as an email attachment. And what they did instead is they embedded the Flash in Excel and then emailed the Excel file. And of course, Excel files are typically associated with actually doing work and business. So they're frequently allowed, and as a result, can get now onto the desktop, and the user may now waste their time playing these Flash games. In this case, it was Word, but you can attach Flash to pretty much any Office document. Yesterday, Microsoft posted a bit of a blog with a few more details about this particular issue. Turns out the subject line claimed that the Word document had more details about the Japanese nuclear reactor problem. Now, another trick that was sort of used by this particular malware, and I've seen this a couple times before, was that once you open the document, the Flash file will run and then Word will crash. But one of the things the Flash code does is it will overwrite the Word document, the bad Word document, with a benign Word document. So if you open it again, you will see a normal Word document. That is supposed to make it harder for the user to realize that they just got exploited. And then also it makes forensics a little bit harder because now you don't really have the original exploit as easily available as just accessing that file. And, well, depending on how your disk is laid out, it may actually been overwritten by this code. So pretty tricky exploit. Nothing here that we haven't seen before. But this vulnerability has not been patched yet. As of the last time I checked, which was last night, Adobe announced they're not going to release an out-of-band patch. They're going to patch that with their next quarterly release, which I think is about 2 months out. If you use Acrobat 10 or PF Reader 10 on Windows, then you have the sandbox option, which provides for a bit more additional protection. I'm not sure if it will protect you from all versions of this exploit, like Flash and Word documents and such, but at least it will protect you from Flash and PDF, which is actually then using the Adobe PDF Reader. The OS 10 version of Acrobat Reader 10 does not have the sandbox feature right now. That's limited to Windows. However, while all versions of Adobe Flash are vulnerable, right now only the Windows version is actually actively been exploited by this particular flaw. Well, so much about current threats that we are seeing. So get your Windows systems patched. Be aware of the tax scams. And then, of course, Flash is always good for some fun with exploited workstations. But then let's take a quick look at DNSSEC and talk a bit about what you can do now to actually protect your DNS infrastructure better than you did in the past. DNS has been the subject of a lot of sort of security ridicule over the years. It has always been seen as kind of the Achilles heel when it came to internet security. It uses UDP, which of course is in itself unreliable and does require the application layer to provide a lot of the reliability, authentication, and so on. So over the years, DNS has been improved. For example, query IDs, initially they used to be incremental and now they're random. Then a couple years back when Dan Kaminsky came out with a better way to exploit the query ID issues and such, then the source port was randomized to give us more randomness here. But overall, we really only have 32 bits of randomness, and that's maximum. You can't really use all source ports. So more realistically, you usually end up with maybe 20 or 24 bits, sort of something of that order of randomness. Anybody creating a web application with session tokens that are 20 or 24 bits long would probably be laughed out of the room by the first pen tester seeing it. But with DNS, we sort of live with it for now. Now, The only real mitigation we had at this point was really to use SSL to authenticate the host we connect to. So in that case, we kind of assume if DNS gives us a bad response, then we connect via SSL. The SSL authentication will fail and alert us that we connected to the wrong host. Now, that's of course only good if we actually use SSL. And there are a lot of applications that don't use SSL. And then even with SSL, we do rely on the user not to bypass that check. We all know how easy it is to click OK whenever there is some kind of SSL violations. So really the goal of DNS is to sign DNS data. So we have a cryptographic verification that the data did not get tampered with and was actually created by someone who is authorized to manage that particular zone. We could theoretically just, you know, use some kind of transport TLS or whatever scheme, or maybe just run all of DNS over TCP and use SSL to validate that. However, that would be rather expensive on our DNS servers. So kind of a goal of DNS is also to not make DNS less reliable than we have to, because availability is another big issue with DNS, and certainly cannot be just ignored when we're talking about DNS security. So really minimizing the work that the server has to do was one of the design efforts, and with that also, you know, the management overhead. Whenever you add additional authorization, signing, hashes, and all of that, of course that adds more management overhead that we then have to deal with. In order to help with the management overhead, DNSSEC pretty much follows sort of what's already there with DNS and sort of that top-down architecture that we have in DNS, starting with the root zone down to individual hosts and such, is reflected in the way DNSSEC works. Now, in order to apply DNSSEC, there are a number of new resource records that were added to DNS. You're probably familiar with the traditional resource records, like you have A records for IPv4 addresses, Quad A records for IPv6 addresses, NS records for name servers, MX for mail servers, and so on. There are about a dozen different of these resource records. Well, one of the records that we add for DNSSEC is the DNS key record. In order to support DNSSEC, we do need keys, and we need to distribute these keys. Now, what DNSSEC does, it leverages our existing DNS infrastructure to distribute our public keys, and that's done via these DNSSEC records. DNS key records. So the most important part of this record is the key itself. The public key is included in this DNS key record. But in addition to that, we have a little bit more additional information. So, for example, we have 16 bits worth of flags, where really only two of these bits are used. Bit 7 is probably the most important one here, the zone key bit. If this bit is set, then this key is actually used to sign this zone. So you should always see this bit set. If it's not set, then the key is ignored. The second bit is bit 15, or essentially the last bit here, the least valuable bit, and that's our secure entry point bit. That bit is actually, for practical purposes, usually ignored. But whenever it is set, it tells the resolver that this key could potentially be used as a trust anchor. A trust anchor is the top-level key that we are trusting. And you may have one or more trust anchors that you use, and then all other keys that you use are signed by these trust anchors. However, in practical use, your DNS resolver should not just accept keys that are offered by zones as trust anchors. So this bit, while you will see it set in some ways, and we'll talk about this bit later, but it's really ignored for practical purposes. Then next we have a protocol that's always three, and that's really just sort of for backward compatibility. And then we have 8 bits for an algorithm. There is a number of different hashing and encryption algorithms that we can use, and the value we find in this bit basically just tells us what algorithm we are using in this particular case. So here a quick example of what one of these DNS key records looks like. This one is taken straight from the RFC. It's used for example.com. So this key could be used to assign records within example.com. It does have a TTL like any DNS resource record. Then it applies to the internet type, and it's a DNS key. 256 just means that our signing bit is set, and our protocol 3, again, that's the fixed value, and algorithm is number 5, which is RSA or SHA-1. The different algorithms you can find set in the DNSSEC RFC, but you have to check later. Additional algorithms got added, and IANA actually has an authoritative list of all the algorithms that are defined. Not all name servers do support all algorithms, and that of course makes it a little bit more tricky, for example, to pick an algorithm that's strong enough and supported by a sufficiently large population of DNS servers. So once we have a key, we also need signatures. Signatures are provided via the RRSIG record. So for each resource record or RR, you have a resource record signature. So now instead of just having one line in your DNS zone, you have two. One is the resource record itself. The other one is the signature that goes with that resource record. And of course, that signature is derived using the private key and then the public key that we advertise via the DNS key record can be used to validate this signature. Now, the resource record signature itself has a couple of additional bits of information in addition to the signature itself, and that's again what type is covered and what is signed, what's the algorithm we are using, how many parts does the actual signed object here have, and how many labels really, and then the TTL of the signed record. So essentially the entire resource record is signed here, not just the value itself. The one thing that's really new here and very different from other DNS resource record is that we do have an inception and an expiration time. DNSSEC requires that you periodically re-sign your zone because these records will expire after some time. Typically after a month or so, and we'll get to this when we talk sort of about some of the best practices involved with that. So here's a quick example of what these records look like. This particular record validates the A record for host.example.com. The TTL of the A record is 1 week here, or 86,400 seconds. Now, the RRSIG record itself has its own TTL, and of course that could be theoretically different from the TTL of the record itself, but it wouldn't really make any sense for these to be different, because whenever our record changes, this signature, of course, has to change too. And then you see here the beginning and end time for whatever time frame this resource record signature is valid for. And then again, somewhat cut off here, the signature itself, which is an encrypted hash. The way these are created is that first a hash is picked, and what hashing algorithm is used, that's again defined here in the algorithm number. So here we have algorithm 5, which means we are using a SHA-1 hash, and then we are using the private key and RSA as an algorithm to encrypt that hash. And of course, now using the public key, we could decrypt this hash and make sure that it's actually valid. Now, okay, this is all great. We can now add these keys and we can add these signatures to our zone. However, let's step back a little bit. What is the actual threat that we are trying to protect from? DNS spoofing. So we try to protect ourselves from someone spoofing the A record for sans.org. If they can spoof the A record, can't they also just spoof the DNS key and the RRSync record? Yes, they can. So we really need to make sure that there is a way to figure out that we actually got the correct key for this zone, that nobody tried to push us a bad key. And that's where these DS records or delegation signer records come in. What we do is we create a hash of our key. And then we send that hash of our key to our parent zone. So for sans.org, we would send that to .org. And then .org will include that delegation signer record in its own zone, and it will sign it with its own key. So that's how that .org essentially validates that this is the correct key for sans.org. And then, of course, the root zone validates whatever key is used for .org. And the root zone's key is then our trust anchor. That's the one key that we have to trust and that we have to essentially load into our DNS server, just like we load the hints file with the IP addresses for all the different root DNS servers. So this is how you make sure that there is sort of a chain of trust established within the DNSSEC architecture. Another problem that we have with DNSSEC is, up to this point, we know how we can sign records that exist. How do we prove that a certain record does not exist? And that's where sort of this authenticated denial of existence problem comes in. We cannot really create a signature for a record that doesn't exist. The initial solution for that problem were NSEC records. These sort of next secure records essentially were records that we had for each one of our resource records that pointed to the next resource record. So now if we're up to 3 total records per resource, we have, for example, our A record, our resource record, then we have a signature for it, and we have a next record for it. That works great because now we can enumerate all the records in the zone, and as a result, we know if there is no record that points, no next sec record that points to our record, well, it doesn't exist. So that works great, but it also works great to download the content of the zone. It's essentially another way to do a zone transfer. And we were all told that zone transfers are bad and we have to turn them off. Because, well, we may by mistake publish a record in our zone that we don't want people to know about. So that's kind of bad about these NSEC records. And this was one of the reasons why people did not implement DNSSEC. Well, in recent RFCs, they updated this and now added another type of record called the NSEC3 record. The NSEC3 record does no longer point to the actual next record, but to a hash of it. So now instead of having explicitly for each record a next record with the explicit name and everything off the next record, we just get a hash, and that still works. We can still make sure that if we are looking for a record, there is no NSEC3 record with that particular hash in it. We can salt it. And in addition to the NSEC3 record, we also have an NSEC3 parameter record that describes how we calculate those NSEC3 records. Again, what hashing algorithms are we going to use, and what kind of salt are we going to use if we choose to use a salt. So for each individual resource record, we do have an NSEC3 record, and for each zone, we have one NSEC3 parameter record. Problem is that this RFC is still fairly new, like about 3 or so years old, so a lot of DNS servers don't yet support it. Windows 2008 R2 does not directly support it. You can delegate zones that support it, so you could basically then delegate it, for example, to a server running Bind that does support these records. Bind 9 supports it in its latest version and started supporting it in version 9.6. I believe some of the versions that come with CentOS 5 and so don't yet support NSEC 3 records. The root zone itself uses NSEC3, so in order to support the signing of the root zone, you do need a server that's able to understand NSEC3. Now, okay, so what's the problem? Sounds great, sounds like you thought about all of it. Why haven't people widely implemented it? Well, the big holdback for the longest time was there was no top-level domain support. So the root zone wasn't signed, .com, .org was not signed, and with that, the only way you could implement this was using essentially a hack, where you use something called look-aside validation. And what look-aside validation does is, you say, hey, don't go to .org, go to someone else, and trust them to sign my zone. So you basically had to add these other trust anchors in order to be able to use DNSSEC. The other problem is really just operational, that the sort of public and big threat of DNS spoofing hasn't really materialized yet. It's more something used in smaller target attacks and such. It essentially doesn't make the headlines. However, if your DNS server is down, that may make the headlines. And so there was really not a lot of incentive for people to really implement it and taking the risk of downtime in order to prevent a threat that wasn't really considered all that real, and really signing up for all of that management overhead you have. Also, historically, DNS was limited to responses of 512 bytes in size, and of course, with all these key records and signature records, you may exceed the size of 512 bytes. So newer methods like eDNS0 and such become a lot more important than they have in the past. Now let's talk about how to implement. And there are really two cases in how you go about implementing implementing DNSSEC. First of all, if you own your own zone and you essentially want to run an authoritative zone, that's when you would sign your own zones and implementing it that way. And then, of course, if you just want to take advantage of others signing their zone, then you have to tell your recursive name server to actually verify these DNSSEC signatures. So how do we get started? And let's start with the case where we are actually signing our own zone. So the authoritative name server case. And that case is a little bit more complex. So that's why I'll start with that, because we'll talk a little bit in more detail about how DNSSEC works. First of all, you have to get your house in order when it comes to DNS. One of the purposes of DNSSEC is to better validate DNS, and as such, making changes actually gets a little bit harder. So having change control in place, making sure your zone itself is consistent, like no leaking and missing name server records, all of that. So make sure you have that all lined out. How do you do your change control? Who's responsible of signing those zones, all of that? And making sure that your current zone is consistent is important before you start playing with DNSSEC, because otherwise you're essentially just ending up signing bad records, and there's really no point in doing that. Secondly, you don't want to just outright start signing a production domain. There are a lot of sort of tricky little operational parts to it. So get some domain that's not used for anything operationally important. Maybe you already have a domain name like that. Essentially something to play with. Something that helps you become familiar with DNSSEC. Then decide on an algorithm. And in order to find the right algorithm, of course, you have to know what your DNS server supports. If there's a particular constituency that you would like to support here or such, maybe pull them. Hey, what DNS servers do you support? What kind of algorithms do they use? And try to stick with that. And we'll talk a little bit later about what the best practices are with that respect, but you may not be able to use the toughest and hardest and most difficult algorithms just because a lot of the name servers that would use your authoritative zone don't support them. And then you need to create keys. Now, there are two sets of keys that you should create, and then one is called the zone signing key, one is called the key signing key, and you should create two each. And of course, each one has a public and a private part. So in the end, you'll end up with a total of 8 key files. From those, you will derive those DS records, and the tools that are used to create the keys will typically also create those DS records for you. So become familiar with those tools. The first couple times, of course, you'll create the wrong keys and they won't work. And you have to play around with that a little bit to make sure that you really understand how these tools work. And then, of course, only the public key goes into your zone file. The private key should stay on the system that you use to actually sign the zones. I would actually recommend to not put the private key on the name server itself. Have some system that you use to sign the zones, and then you push your zone files, maybe SCP or whatever protocol you prefer, to the name server, and then reload the name server. If you do need dynamic updates, that's supported as well. But again, you have to make sure that you understand how that works and how to apply that correctly. So I mentioned already there are two different keys that you need. You need a key signing key and you need a zone signing key. Now, there's a reason why there are two keys. The quick rundown on what they do is the zone signing key is the key that you actually use to sign resource records. So that's the key that will be used to create those RRSIC records. The key signing key is the one that's used to sign the zone signing key. Now, why do we need two keys? The reason here is really sort of a trade-off between speed and security. The zone signing key will be used by resolving name servers whenever they look up one of your resource records, because then they get the signature and they have to verify it. So we don't want to make that key excessively large. However, if we keep that key a little bit on the short side, then we have to rotate it more frequently. The key that we deposit with our parent zone, we don't want to change that out every few weeks. So that's what the key signing key is for. The key signing key is longer and stronger, and it will last longer That's why we keep it with our parent zone. And we only use it to sign other zone signing keys. So really, that key isn't used very much in day-to-day use. And we can make it strong without impacting performance too much. And so this is why we have two keys, a zone signing key and a key signing key. Other than that, they're really identical, and both of them are published in our zone. The public key for both of these is a DNS key record in our zone. Now, here are a couple of best practices for these keys. These best practices are mostly taken from a NIST document. I'll mention the exact location of that later. But the key signing key should be at least 2048 bits and should have a lifetime of about 1 to 2 years. What people should usually do is make the lifetime of the key 13 months, but then rotate it once a year, so after 12 months. So you have another month kind of in case things go wrong or you need extra time to rotate it. Then the zone signing key is only 1,024 bits and has a lifetime of about 1 to 3 months. Overall, the total size of these keys, the shortest you could possibly have is 512 bits. And for RSA keys, you can get them up to 4,096 bits. Now, as far as algorithms go, you should use RSA. At least you should use RSA SHA-1, but if your name server supports it, you should do RSA SHA-256. And then again, create two of the each key. So in case you have to revoke one of those keys, you still have the other one to be able to sign. All of these keys, so all four public keys, will be published in your zone. You only use one of those keys to actually do the signing, but you could use any of them, and some records could be signed by one key, others by another key. And then make sure that you publish new keys about 1 to 4 weeks before you actually start using them. Now, what's the real difference between the zone signing and the key signing key? I had that problem in the past. I create them and then I don't remember which one is which. Well, really, there is no real difference between them. You could use either to sign keys, or you could use either to sign zone data. However, it's sort of convention to set the secure entry point flag on the key signing key. It's not really used for anything. It's really just a convention to help you tell the two keys apart. So in your DNS key record, the key that has 257 as flag should be the key signing key. The one that has 256 as flag should be the zone signing key. And here, just to make it clear, that's sort of the trust chain. That's how your data is validated. So some resolver is downloading a resource record from your machine, and then the appropriate signature that comes with it. It then knows the signature is correct because, well, it also downloads the DNS key record for the zone signing key that was used to create that signature. It knows that zone signing key is correct because, well, it is also itself assigned using the key signing key, and it knows that key signing key is correct because there is a DS record in the parent zone that's signed using the parent's zone signing key. And then, of course, the parent zone signing key has its own parent zone that signs it until we end up with the root zone that's our trust anchor. Okay, so much about key, but we are not done yet. We just created our keys. Next, we want to sign our zone. So we take our zone file, we add all these key records, and then we sign the zone file. The utility that you'd commonly use to sign the zone file also has an option to automatically increment the serial number. Whenever you re-sign the zone file, you should increment the serial number on the SON file. So go through that procedure. Make sure you know what to do in order to re-sign the key. See if you can cron that or whatever to automate it, or set up a calendar entry to tell you every 2 months or what your time frame is to re-sign the key, create new SON signing keys, and push that all out. Keep that up there for a while. Make sure everything is working right. Once you know everything is working right, then you take your DS record and send it to your parent zone. You typically do that using your registrar. So you have to make sure that your registrar is supporting DNSSEC DS records before you do that. GoDaddy, for example, does that now. Not 100% sure if they do it for .com yet, but they definitely do it for .org. So before you get all of this started, make sure that your registrar supports this as well. And then, of course, test. Keep that up and running. Like I said, for a few months, so you go through a couple of these re-signing procedures and you make sure everything is actually working correctly before you move on to any of your production zones and go through that process. So that's how you set it up for your authoritative zones. How about your resolvers? Well, resolvers are a lot easier because all you have to give them is you have to give them one or more trust anchors. And the obvious trust anchor that you need is the key for the root zone. Here's the URL from IANA.org where you can download the current trust anchor key. If you use look-aside validation or such, you may have additional trust anchors that you load. Then you have to figure out how to update those trust anchors because they will rotate occasionally. There is now a very new protocol, defined RFC 5011, that allows the DNS server to automatically pull new trust anchors, and it has sort of an interesting protocol set up to make sure that they're valid and everything. So you may want to look into that and see if your DNS server supports this automatic updating of trust anchors. Bind 9.7 does support it. Not sure about any other DNS servers that do support it at this point. And then, of course, you want to test and monitor. Watch your logs. Watch for excessive failures to make sure that your SON, first of all, is not attacked, so you don't see any failure for that reason, but you know, outdated keys and all of that. The big problem will be to keep availability high while adding this additional significant complication to the way your DNS infrastructure is set up. And here I have a couple of URLs with various resources for you. DNSSEC.net, that's where you find links to all of the RFCs and a lot of scripts and tools and best practices reports and things like that. So that's definitely recommended. The second link here is a European Union organization that sort of came up with DNSSEC best practices. Pretty good, pretty well focused just on DNSSEC. And then we have NIST 800-81. That's the NIST publication to secure DNS servers. It does have a lot of best practices that go beyond DNSSEC, somewhat specific to bind and how to secure bind. Note there is a revision 1 to this document. So get the latest version of it. And it is very detailed on things like key strengths. Of course, if FISMA applies to you, that's probably the publication that you want to use as a guide to implement that for your DNS server. Anyway, this is it for today. So thanks again for listening. We don't have any Q&A session there because for the original webcast, I forgot to record it. So I went back and recorded it myself. If you do have any questions, feel free to email me or contact us at the Internet Storm Center. Use our contact page to actually get the contact with us. Usually works better than email because well, we have less spam filtering and such for this. Also, still Twitter if you would like to follow me, and I still do have a daily podcast if you're interested in audio content just on the ISC website. You should find links for that in our audio tab if you don't see it on the homepage. That's published once a day, and it's about 5 minutes worth of sort of you know what happened that day in security. And then, of course, you know, my other hobby is IPv6, and we do have an IPv6 summit coming up in Washington, D.C., right ahead of the SANS Fire Conference. Anyway, thanks again for listening, and talk to you again in May. Bye.